Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Brian Koberger, we're going to talk about him today because there's news. There's smoke out there in the ether. So let's identify if there's a fire or if it's time to bring out the extinguisher. Four University of Idaho students obviously killed in their beds. You probably know the story. The man who admitted to doing it is serving four consecutive life sentences. The families were told it was over, and now a forensic expert hired by Koberger's own defense is going public with claims that the most important physical evidence in the case may have been mishandled. I'm going to underline the word may there. And that he warned the defense before the plea. What's coming out is raising questions that a courtroom was supposed to answer but never really did because, well, they accepted a plea from Brian Koberger. Joining us to have this conversation, as always, my co-host Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program with the FBI, and Eric Fattis, a former prosecutor and defense attorney.
The man.
Yeah, kind of a, it's getting some headlines here. Koberger's defense had a forensic expert telling them the knife sheath, allegedly, the only physical evidence carrying his DNA, might have been challengeable at trial. That's the claim that is coming out of this new book anyway, and the former expert. And they took the plea deal anyway. Let's for a moment say, okay, maybe this is a challengeable. Eric, you've been a prosecutor building a case and on evidence like that, and the defense attorney is trying to tear it apart. Does this decision make any sense to you, that if they if this expert had come to Ann Taylor earlier on, or maybe he did come to Ann Taylor, it's, I believe he claims he did, and then Ann says, yeah, let's take the plea anyway. What does that say to you about what was going on behind the scenes here?
Sure. So a lot of unknowns, a lot of moving parts there. But, you know, typically as defense counsel, when you're deciding whether to take a plea and to advise your client to do that, you got to look at all of the evidence. So if some expert comes to you and they say, hey, there might be an issue with this piece of evidence, and it's an important piece of evidence, you certainly have to thoroughly consider that. You know, just the fact that it may be challengeable doesn't mean that you'll prevail on that challenge. It doesn't mean that it proves his innocence necessarily. And I'm wondering if defense counsel looked at that and said, yeah, but look at the substantial weight of all this other evidence. They could try to kill him. And this plea agreement spares his life. On the balance, it's still a good deal for the client. I'm just wondering if that was the analysis of the defense counsel.
Yeah, and that's a good point, too, because it still spares his life. And I remember, first of all, I got to say, I really hate this. We were talking about before the show, I am such a victim's advocate, and the Gonzaleses and all the families that are involved, that shame on these people doing this. But that aside now, I'm with you, Eric, in the fact that it spared his life, which was on the balance. And at the same time, remember, the police department and the prosecutor, every time Ann Taylor kept coming back and trying to challenge a DNA or the knife sheath and all the motions that she was making, I remember very clearly the prosecution saying, we're good without it. Do whatever you want. They were so steady with their confidence with what they had, irrespective of this one thing, that I don't get, and that's my question to you, is I don't get why they're trying to make a deal of this now.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit unclear. You know, I think you mentioned that this assertion is contained within a book from this expert who might have a personal interest in making money off that book and sensationalizing what he believes his opinion was. But Yeah, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely to change things, but you never know what a court might do with that. We haven't seen a motion to withdraw the plea yet, but could we see that? That could be coming down the pike, and there could be a host of new legal issues in this years-long saga.
Is it? And I know, I'm sorry, Tony, you know, I keep doubling up. Is that even a possibility that they can withdraw that plea?
It's a possibility that they could file a motion to try to do that. But doing that is extraordinarily difficult. It is almost never granted, especially after a sentence has been imposed. There are very limited exceptions. But Koberger, what else does he have to lose? He's in prison forever. So wouldn't be surprised if he sort of tries to avail himself of what appears to be a possible last resort.
Especially with the judge kept slapping him down last time, too. Anyway, go ahead.
Well,
Tony.
I mean, this feels like, I mean, it feels like it can be dismissed pretty damn quickly, and probably why it. And I'm just guessing here. I'm reading the tea leaves of where this might have went behind the scenes, with this being expressed to Ann Taylor before Koberger ever made the plea. It has been answered as to, because we're getting down to a chain of custody question. That's the big thing that is being argued here by this expert. And then the other issue is the fact that he's revealing this, and Ann Taylor is saying that it's violating a non-disclosure agreement. We'll get to that part too. There's two issues at play, but the part about the chain of custody, that, I mean, I debunked in 3 minutes this morning when I started digging into it. Where, okay, chain of custody, yes, in old school land of evidence, and probably in some departments still to this day, you have your sheet and everybody logs it. Whoever has anything to do with this piece of evidence, chain of custody, point A to point B, who has it? You sign it, you date it, there you go. The argument that's being made here, so everyone can understand it, is that he's saying he looked at the chain of custody receipt, basically, on the evidence bag for the sheath, and it looked like it was written by the same person with the same pen on the same day, showing a litany of different dates. And in this person's opinion, that person, the author here, or the expert, is saying that, well, that doesn't seem to be right. This looks like not an authentic chain of custody note. This looks like somebody just wrote it all down. Okay, I mean, on its surface, that's kind of interesting, because chain of custody should be differently. But then we find out, oh, the department, they digitally scan everything with barcodes, and it's all tracked digitally far more accurately than someone with a pen and a piece of paper. So that piece of paper, the chain of custody list, could simply have been somebody taking the digital list and then putting it physically on the paper so someone could reference it without going physically into the digital evidence system, which is privately held by the police department. There you go. It's explained. It's not like up in the air for a lot of litigation or questioning. Makes for a great headline, sure, nonetheless. But at the end of the day, feels kind of like a nothing burger to me. I don't know. I mean, this, of course, you know, where could that be litigated? Is it as clear cut as it may feel to me, Eric?
You know, Tony, like you're talking about, it's not uncommon for notations to be made after the fact. Look, as when I was a prosecutor and even as a defense attorney, I tried to take notes contemporaneous with all of my hearings and all of my client communications. Sometimes you're in trial, sometimes there are other pressing matters, and you do it at a later time. You sort of reconstruct what has already happened. And that would not be unusual for a police department to do, especially when they have purportedly a digital record of this stuff being checked in and checked out and handled and that kind of thing. And so I bet Ann Taylor, when she was presented with this, if she was, kind of said, hey, this is not going to make it so that Koberger is found not guilty. There is just so much more going on. And in fact, these apparent notation issues can be explained away through department procedures and through customs and standards. It's not a bombshell to me.
No.
It's not something that shows he's innocent.
And I just don't even like, it's a former FBI guy that got out after 15 years that wrote this book and is bringing this up. First of all, you know, we had Howard Bloom on the show way back when, who wrote the great book and did amazing investigative research on this case. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it was as much behind the scenes as you can get with him. And it was When the Night Comes Falling, I think is what it's called, Tony.
Yeah. Yep.
Fantastic read. And then you have James Patterson and his sources doing this. And then you have this guy coming along. And what bothers me is it's poking at something that was already resolved. It was already flushed out because I mean, we commented on the show numerous times. Well, if you're going to have a defense attorney, and Eric, I'm curious about you this as well. Do you agree, Ann Taylor? I mean, if you need a defense attorney on your side, I want you, I want Bob Motto, or I want Ann Taylor. I mean, holy yeah. crap. I mean, she was flushing this out every single day. I mean, she was doing all she could. And then you get this guy who should be a victim's advocate. You know, and I don't like the what it's doing, potentially doing to the families. I mean, these are strong families. You know, I'm fascinated to see what the Gonsalveses might have to say about this. But I do not like the fact that this was brought up, not because it's, you know, it was something that was righteous that was missed. No, because there's nothing missed. Like, why are they doing this? Anyway.
Yeah, in my appraisal, Ann Taylor was very diligent, very thorough, explored all possible avenues. And when talking about the legal issues of this chain of custody, while those can be issues raised at trial, the burden to admit evidence for chain of custody purposes is very low. It's like essentially an authenticity standard. Is there credible evidence that this item is what it purports to be? And if there are some notation issues regarding it, a judge is probably going to say, hey, you can cross-examine on those notation issues, but I'm letting it in. And I bet Ann Taylor said, gosh, this is coming in either way, and it's going to be damning.
Should Ann Taylor have not written a response to this? Because I'm almost thinking like Ann Taylor responding, and I'm trying to understand why she did, and I think I see why she did, because it almost questions her ability as an attorney of, well, oh my gosh, if this blazing piece of evidence is right here and you didn't act on it and you didn't even give him a chance to argue this in court, what's wrong with you? I can see why one as an attorney would be like, okay, no, this is not what it appears to be or what you're claiming it is. But at the same point, making that statement brought a ton of attention back over here to the case with a book that may probably really, I mean, there's been a lot of Koberger books that have come out. Nobody really pays much attention. They're going to keep coming. They will keep coming forever. I mean, it feels like publicity stunt that we're going to trigger Ann Taylor to have to make this response to defend herself. And then at the same point, that brings us a lot of attention to our book. I don't know. That's kind of my conjecture as I'm looking at this.
It's mine.
Yeah, I hear you, Tony. And you know, I can't speak for Ann Taylor, but speaking for myself and nearly all the attorneys I know, some of them have egos. And some of them, you know, when someone challenges you and mm-hmm. your legal work, you know, you went to law school, you have a doctorate, you're proud of what you do. Yeah. And when someone calls that into question, I can understand feeling compelled to defend oneself and to defend their work. One of the biggest things on the ethics listserv that I'm on is when someone leaves a bad review, how can the attorney respond? Because they're so giddy to sort of react to those kinds of accusations about their professional ethics and mm-hmm. their professional character. So not surprising that she did this, but I agree that it had an inadvertent consequence of bringing more attention to it.
Yeah. I mean, I get why I don't blame her for doing it at all. But yeah, I think the inadvertent consequences there.
Yeah, and I don't think she needed to. I mean, I don't think anyone in the world watching this or witnessing it as deeply as we did, or anyone else that covered it, would say that she was incompetent or missed anything in any way.
No.
I mean, matter of fact, I mean, it was really pretty striking. It was fearful for people that really thought he was guilty before proven in a court of law. I'm not saying I was, but I mean, she did a very, very thorough job. I'm more so than we saw in most cases. Matter of fact, we comment every single case after for a while. I was like, oh, they need to get Ann Taylor.
Yeah. Let's talk about the non-disclosure aspect of this, right? Because that seems to be, I mean, really what brought Ann Taylor to speak about this. They're saying that he violated the non-disclosure, and that still is in effect even after this trial. He's saying, you know what, this is all public information that has been in document. jumps. I'm just commenting on it. What are your thoughts on the non-disclosure on a case that's already been, you know, it's been settled. It is settled law. This is all done and over. But yeah, non-disclosures still do exist. But is that the case here? Is he really violating it, or what's your take?
You know, it would depend on the specific language of the non-disclosure agreement, Tony. But one thing I'll mention is that NDAs are rather uncommon in this set of circumstances. So when there is especially a public defender representing somebody, and they consult with an expert, you usually don't make the expert sign an NDA. Now, this case, you know, it has coverage throughout the world. And so perhaps she was just trying to be diligent and thorough as she has been with the NDA piece. But also, like you said, if it is public information, I don't know that you can prevent somebody from simply commenting on public information. You could prevent like secret or private communications from being disclosed. I'm just not so sure there's a lot of traction on this allegation of a violation of an NDA.
And let's talk about that NDA for a second too, Eric, if we could, because Jim Bob Duggar uses NDAs like they're falling out his butt. And a lot of people, we use them in the FBI, I remember, with confidential human sources a lot. I remember, and I want your legal opinion on this, because we would go to our attorneys sometimes when we gave it to a source that would have them sign an NDA. And our attorneys would say, yeah, it's more of a psychological block for them talking than a legal block, because there's really not a lot of teeth behind them. So can you tell me what exactly the consequences for violating an NDA are and what the law would say about it?
So there are usually two ways that the consequences are handled. One way is within the NDA, and it usually will say, hey, if there's a violation of this NDA, you're going to owe this amount. And if you violate it a second time, you're going to owe a greater amount. Sometimes it's written into the NDA in that fashion. Other times it is not, and that's a little messier, because you've got to talk about what are the damages that result from a violation of this NDA. Did someone lose money because of this disclosure? Probably not. Did someone sustain reputational harm because of this? Possibly, and how do you quantify that? And so I think it just kind of goes to your point, Robin, that these have a psychological compulsion, but not always a legal compulsion.
Are they about as challenging to prove as a defamation case, do you think?
Well, it depends, because in the NDA context, at least you have a written document. You know exactly what the rules are, what you can and cannot say, hopefully. Whereas with defamation, it can be a little murkier. You know, defamation opinions aren't defamation. It has to be a statement of fact. If there's a public official involved, it has to be actual malice. There's all these other conditions. Whereas with the NDA, it's kind of in black and white, hey, what you can and can't do. But the enforceability of that NDA can really become an issue in court.
Thank you.
Lots of questions on this. And I think it's, you know, it's a story that's going to probably come and go here pretty quick. It's red meat to the pro burgers out there. The problem with it is it's something that's just one element of a much larger cornucopia of evidence against Brian Koberger, and it's already kind of debunked. So the folks that are looking at this going, see, it's something. It's like, yeah, still really not something. Just because somebody over here says it's something doesn't mean it actually is something. Brian Koberger said he liked to look at the stars for a long time, too, till he said, yes, I killed those four people one after another in a courtroom. So,
yeah, and remember, that. And when we're just looking at the case in its entirety anyway, it was they were going to, I remember the police department said this numerous times, the DNA in that knife sheath helped, but it wasn't what gave them everything. And it's a huge piece of it, which was fantastic for the case and the prosecution. But again, they had the car on video. They had his location. They had the cell phone triangulation. And they had DNA before this, you know, anyway.
And you just got Koberger. You look at him for like 5 minutes. You're like, yeah, that's a creepy motherfucker.
His right life there. Arc said, I was going to do this.
Exactly. Yes. Koberger being Koberger said he was going to do this.
I mean, so, because remember, I don't know where it stands right now. The Gonzaleses were filing the lawsuit against the university for missing all the red flags and warning signs and not firing them already because of all the creepy crap he was doing to all the students there. I mean, there is a plethora. There's mounds to my visual stuff. I love, there's mounds of crap that says he's guilty, and it's why he pled and admitted it. And now writing a book around one thing that's a conjecture.
Hey, when there's money to be made, there's people who will go for it. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue the conversation right there. Let's move over to the Reiners. 4.5 months after Rob and Michelle Reiner were found stabbed to death in their Brentwood home, an autopsy report on how they died still ain't finished. The case against their son, Nick, has now been pushed to September. And it's not a trial. It's not even the preliminary hearing yet. It's a date to potentially set the preliminary hearing. We're getting like close to a year anniversary where we'll get to the preliminary hearing. The defense says it needs more discovery. The prosecution says it's waiting on the medical examiner. Both sides agreed to the delay because you don't have the information. You don't have the information. And Nick Reiner, the man facing two counts of first degree murder with death penalty eligibility, sat in court, consulted by his public defender, and said one word: yeah. So what is actually happening behind the scenes in this case, and what does the pace of this thing tell us about what both sides are building towards? Joining me to discuss, as always, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis. Eric, if you're Jake or Romy Reiner right now, you lost both parents to violence. The person accused is your own brother. And the court just told you, come back in September, 5 months from now, for a hearing that isn't even a real hearing. This has got to be very, you know, devastating emotionally to the family. Because from the outside, it looks like nobody's in a hurry to get justice for Rob and Michelle. And I have to imagine the people who love them are watching this timeline and somewhat losing their minds. But that's the emotional side. Emotional side and legal side are two very different things and require very different framework to operate. But a year in for the preliminary hearing, I mean, is this crazy? Is this normal? Give me your thoughts.
I'm not sure I've ever seen such a delay just to get to the preliminary hearing stage. That's like the second step in a case like this, among like dozens of steps. So, you know, we're not even there yet. This is a nightmare for these folks that won't end. And in terms of what's going on, it's a bit of a head scratcher. Autopsies can take some time. I have seen them take about this amount of time or so. But especially if this was like a very violent death, like a clear stabbing or shooting or whatever, like usually those conclusions can be drawn rather quickly, and the autopsy, the medical examiner can amend their report later if need be. But delay, which might inure to the benefit of the defense.
Sure. I mean, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, I get you want to cross your T and dot your I. I know that this is going to be a case that's going to be under a microscope. So you really want to be sure you got everything and you can present it. But the method of death isn't really like even up for question here. It's like, we know he did it. It's more so why he did it. And was he in a state of mind where he could be held legally responsible for understanding he was causing the death of someone at that moment? Are those answers to be found in the physical reflection of an autopsy?
Not at all. No. In fact, most medical examiners expressly opine that, hey, not only can I not conclude who did this, but I can't conclude what was going on in their heads. That's outside the purview of their expertise. They can't talk about that. And also, Tony, with the preliminary hearing coming up, even if there are potential mental health defenses, those are rarely even considered at a preliminary hearing. And when they are, the judge usually says, hey, my job is to decide if there's problems probable cause for these charges. There might be defenses. There might be things that side can raise at trial. But the scope of preliminary hearing is rather narrow. Is there probable cause? We don't need a full mental health evaluation and all these mental health experts. I doubt they'd even be allowed to testify at the preliminary hearing. So what are we waiting for?
Yeah. So I'm curious about this one, Eric. I'm gonna flip from the legal side to the maybe a pragmatic side on the human behavior side. Do you think, since you said it will, if it's gonna benefit anyone, it's gonna benefit defense on this to keep delaying this out? Do you think that, because we keep hearing all the issues they're having with Nick behind bars, and I mean, we're seeing it. He hasn't let go of his victim mentality. He still looks like a super nutter. All these things. Do you think defense might be delaying a bit to try all they can to try to regulate those meds he's on so they can actually potentially, since they know it's going to go to trial unless they plead out, which is another question I have, if you think he's going to do that. But do you think they're trying to make him a more compelling individual by delaying more to try to get those meds regulated out, and the more time they have, the greater chance they have at it? Or is that just, am I just doing too much thought experiment?
That very well could be a part of it. Along those lines, too, there might be some competency issues. And sometimes those are not made public. Sometimes there are private hearings and even meetings in chambers with judges about very sensitive private matters like that. I'm wondering if there might be some ongoing competency issue, because for this guy to be competent and face trial, he has to have an awareness of the charges and he has to be able to materially aid in his own defense. And perhaps defense is saying, hey, we've met with this guy and he's screwed. We're not there yet, but we're not ready to raise competency just yet. Judge, why don't you give us a little more time to work on the meds, to work on the psychological piece of this, and try to get this in a place where it can be tried. It's at least possible that those conversations are being had and the public is unaware of them.
Is that a reason why also the prosecution might go along and agree to the delay too, because they want to make sure there's less chance for appeals after that?
I think that could be a part of it. If there was potential competency issues, prosecution doesn't want to convict somebody when there is a question as to whether they're competent and have that conviction come back. So maybe prosecution's like, hey, defense is working with this guy. They've got a meds regimen and they've got counselors who I'm sure he's seeing. And so we'll let them kind of do their thing to ensure that we can secure a conviction and that it remains final at the appellate stage.
My guess is we figured it out.
Well, I mean, give me some insight here on how the sausage is made. I mean, if this is a red herring to the public and we're like, this is the cover story, this is what we're telling the public right now, why not just say there's competency issues right now and we're going to, we need some time to get there. We've seen it in Daybell. We've seen it in a gazillion cases where it's not like, oh, they're kind of out of it right now. Game over. It's like, no, we're going to give them a chance to kind of get back on the saddle here so they can be competent in court. Why not just explain it that way? I mean, is it ethical? Is it even legal to delay the hearing here under a publicly stated false pretense? Does this happen behind the scenes where everybody back in the judge's chambers are on the same page of this is competency, but yeah, we don't have the autopsy yet, so let's just say it's that to the media. Does that happen?
It would be very unusual. But this is a very unusual case. You know, we were just talking about Koberger recently, where a public defender had one of their experts sign an NDA regarding that expert work, apparently. That is extremely uncommon, but the world's eyes were on that case. The world's eyes are on this case.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't, and judges have discretion often to control the proceedings, to maintain decorum and integrity of the judicial institution. And there are things that happen what's called under seal. There are things that happen that are just not publicly available. So it's possible. But if defense really did think that their client had competency issues, usually you have an ethical duty to raise that. And then there's a whole sort of parallel competency procedure that you have to go through. So, I would say certainly unusual. It's an unusual case.
But again, it could be possible that, you know, it's a legitimate claim about the medical examiner's report, But since they're seeing, you know, so they can be slow walking that, knowing that the next issue they may have is a competency issue, buying time just because they think it might be an issue. I mean, just listening to Nick makes me think it's going to be an issue.
Yeah, and you know, Robin, I can understand the prosecutor really wanting to have that autopsy report by the time of the preliminary hearing. That is usually a critical piece of a preliminary hearing, and they probably just want to make sure that they have all of this ready to roll, so there are no missteps, there are no outs. That could be a piece of this delay as well.
And he's behind bars anyway. You know, it's one of these things. He's not on the loose. He's not on bail. And he's suffering behind bars. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of strange.
When is the time for the defense of Nick Reiner to queue up the not guilty by reason of insanity plea? Because right now it's just sitting as not guilty. Under California law, you have to do two pleas. You have to do not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity, two different filings. But they only got the one. Is that something that they are literally waiting for the pretrial hearing to bring that up? Is there a reason to wait for that? Is it more strategic on their part to wait for that rather than throwing that into the ether before the autopsy comes out?
In most jurisdictions, Tony, there is the courts want people to raise issues like not guilty of reason of insanity promptly. It's not something you can just sit on and then like do a trial by ambush thing a few weeks before the trial. I'm like, oh, actually, you know what? He's not guilty by reason of insanity. Now prosecution catch up. Usually you have to raise that quickly, just as you have to do with alibi in most jurisdictions. It's not something you can just sit on and wait. So it's a bit unusual that they haven't raised it yet. I'm sure they have done at least an initial mental health evaluation. And usually that initial evaluation can tell a defense attorney, hey, we have a viable NGRI plea or we don't. Unclear why they wouldn't be in a position to raise that defense if they're going to raise it.
When do you see the last, like the deadline for them being able to do that?
It varies by jurisdiction, but you know, I think in Colorado it says something like as early as practicable. And so, you know, if you've had the mental health evaluation and you have grounds to believe you're going to raise a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, you got to do it. There isn't always a hard and fast deadline; varies by jurisdiction, but it's usually the it's customary to have to do that early on, man. You can't just sit on that.
Is that another reason to delay right now using the medical examiner's excuse to do that so they could get more time to get that in? I'm just kind of stabbing at the
wall. I think they've had enough time.
You would think.
You know, in cases where I've explored that, we did that within the first, you know, month and a half after the incident. And here we're going on months and months and months. I just don't see a reason why they haven't raised it yet if they believe that it's a valid defense.
I just keep going back to what the hell is taking nearly a year for an autopsy to be performed. I mean, is there that much of a backlog and it doesn't really matter who you are or what's pending? We're just got to, I mean, they got the bodies. This is done. I mean, what more can possibly be needed to have extra time to complete this report? This just doesn't make any logical sense to me. Is there anyone in this case, defense or prosecution, that could somehow put a wedge into this that would be delaying that report in some way, shape, or I don't know the answer to this question, but it just it's a red flag. It doesn't make any sense to me. And when you see a red flag in something kind of critical as an autopsy, you're like, what the hell is going on here? Why is it? Rather than just accepting, they're slow.
Yeah, no, it's a head scratcher, you know, compared to look at the case of Barry Morphy, right? So Suzanne Morphy, yeah, his wife and the alleged victim in the case, her body wasn't found until at least a year after she disappeared. Yeah. It was all decomposed and the elements had gone through it. You know, and so that's in that case where they had to like go into her bones and try to find this extremely esoteric poison that they claim they found. That's going to take a good amount of time. But when you have a rather traditional means of death that these coroners have experienced, I imagine, hundreds of times, what would be the hang-up? Why can't you just issue the autopsy report with the apparent findings? I just don't get it. Has there been turnover in the office? Has it I just don't know. It's strange.
I'm curious. Did they get Celeste, in the David case, did they get her autopsy and she was like severely decomposed in a bag? What? I think they got hers faster than this. I mean, she was right. a puddle in a bag, in a frunk.
It might be the same folks, honestly.
I know. Maybe they took too long doing hers.
I don't know.
Good point.
And because so what are they? I mean, what takes so long in this autopsy? I mean, it's not. I mean, it's a. I mean, it's gunshots. I mean, just what the hell? I don't get it.
I hear you.
Yeah, there's just it's a big question, and I think one that deserves an answer. Maybe some more digging there might be a good idea. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure to weigh in. The links are in the description. All right, let's kick it old school now, everybody. Almost 30 years.
This was
who
hard.
Wants to feel old today? 30 years coming this September since Tupac was gunned down on Cobalt and Flamingo in Las Vegas. And let's be honest, Eric, have you been to Vegas and driven by Cobalt and Flamingo and gone, oh, that's where it is? I think every time I'm in Vegas, I'm like, hey, there it is. Because inevitably the drive from the airport takes you by it.
Yeah, I was out there a couple of weeks ago, and I'm pretty sure we rolled right through it.
I think I've shown my daughter the spot like 5 times now in life. It's like, hey, there, like, thanks, Dad. I already know that's where Tupac was shot. Anyway, his family just made the most aggressive legal move this case has ever seen, a wrongful death civil lawsuit that names Keefe D and up to 100 unnamed John Doe co-conspirators the family believes helped plan, finance, and carry out the murder. But the lawsuit is not just about accountability here. It's about discovery. The discovery machine built to force testimony that documents out of people who have never been compelled to answer a single question under oath. With Keefe D's criminal trial set for August and the civil case now running on a parallel track, the legal battlefield around this case just doubled in size, and the implications for everyone connected to it are enormous. Joining me to discuss, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and attorney Eric Faddis, former prosecutor and defense attorney. Eric, the Shakur family, what's left of it, filed this as a wrongful death suit. The brother of Tupac did this, but they lined up to 100 unnamed co-conspirators, John Doe's, alongside Keefe D. Let's help everybody understand this. When a family goes this route, they hired the firm Quinn Emanuel behind them. It feels less like a lawsuit and more like a private investigation with subpoena power. What does this tell you about what the family is actually expecting to try and get to the bottom of through discovery?
Totally. So one thing it tells me, Tony, is their objective probably is not money, because there is little to no collectability likelihood on a wrongful death case like this. GVD's already in jail. I don't know of any significant assets that he has. And these unnamed folks, you can't get money from an unnamed person. And even if you do name them, trying to attach personal assets in a wrongful death case is so cumbersome and futile for the most part. So my apprehension is that their objective is something else. It's truth finding. As you mentioned, when this discovery process proceeds on the civil case, they'll be able to subpoena folks for depositions where they have to sit under oath and be peppered with questions about about the event and any potential involvement. And so, it seems like their objective here might be truth instead of money, which is a little bit refreshing.
How deep in the truth barrel can they go, I guess, when you're naming just John Doe's in a civil case and then you want to depose people? You can't just, I guess, maybe you can, I don't know, just willy-nilly throw names out there. Hey, I want to talk to this person. You were around at that time. Diddy, I want to talk to you. Corrupt, I want to talk to you. Just name all these people that were around Tupac at the moment of his death. Some that have been implicated before, some who were just on the same record label, if you will. What is this, the truth-finding mission, and how much power does that do they hold in terms of subpoenaing people and getting people in for depositions? Can, by filing this, can they get Diddy in for a deposition? Because that seems to be where a lot of roads keep leading. I'm not saying it anything to do with the murder of Tupac, but obviously there's a lot of questions there and a lot of people that want to get him in to find out what he knew on the record of this case at that time and today. Can they get there with this?
You know, I think they can certainly try, and I would not be surprised to see Diddy asked to sit for a deposition. But in this context, especially with the parallel criminal case and the specter of possible criminal consequences, that can allow deponents to invoke their Fifth Amendment rights and to not provide information during a deposition or written discovery or something else. You know, as opposed to like a car accident case where you can subpoena in the driver and then their passenger or whatever, and they're not going to invoke the Fifth in that context. But in this context, where they could be facing a murder charge if they incriminate themselves in some fashion, that could be a barrier to finding truth here. That being said, the latitude that civil litigants have in the discovery process is pretty broad. It's not the same as a trial where there are all these rules, like it has to be relevant and it has to be authentic and it it can't be hearsay, things like that. Those rules are stored during the discovery process. So broad latitude for these folks, but also some potential legal barriers.
Yeah, I mean, they're spending a lot of time, money, and resources for the only thing we can guess at is, from what you're saying, is some truth and transparency. What other potential gains could they get out of this?
You know, Robin, if they so like I said, there's no reasonable likelihood of collectability on any sort of damages for Keefe D, in my opinion. But, you know, sometimes through the discovery process, you learn about the involvement of other folks. You learn about the potential civil responsibility of other folks, like folks who have money, folks who still have assets, folks who are, you know, are successful entertainers. And so perhaps they're saying, hey, let's start with Keefe D and let's, and the people around him, let's build our knowledge base. Let's see if we can develop any ties through this discovery process by which we can potentially add more defendants. That's why they included up to 100 John Does. It's because they want to replace those John Does with actual names, potentially, of folks who have money.
So basically, it's an expensive fishing expedition?
that's certainly how defense would characterize it on that. And perhaps you're not too far off.
Do we see that? Is that kind of common in doing these types of civil suits after such a long time has elapsed?
It's not terribly common because there's not a ton of incentive for the attorneys. Usually on such a civil suit, the attorney would get paid from a percentage of any settlement or verdict. But if there is no reasonable likelihood of the financial recovery, how are these attorneys being paid? Through fame, through name recognition, I suppose. But that's a shit ton of work to do over the course of what could be years.
All right. Thank you.
How much latitude does Diddy have to say, I'm not coming in for this. Can't nobody hold me down. I'll be missing you. You guys have fun over there. What kind of latitude does he have to not show up for a deposition? And what sort of, you know, legal repercussions could exist if he just says, no, I got enough problems. I don't need more money or more problems. I don't need to go for this deposition. I'm a bad boy for life. Go shake a tail feather. What do you think? I think I worked in about
Tony's
seven.
Tony's radio background shines through every day.
I think I nailed about seven Diddy songs in that question on purpose.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, but what sort of latitude does he have?
Well played. So he can't just outright refuse without any sort of legal response if he is properly served with documents requiring his attendance at a deposition. However, he can file a motion to quash, if he was subpoenaed for this deposition, he can file a motion to quash saying, hey, I'm just going to invoke my Fifth Amendment right anyway. This is a meaningless procedure, and court, don't make me come do this.
They can't just say, come with me. Da da da.
How many more of these you got up your sleeve?
I don't know. He only had so many hit songs. He was usually on. He was usually somebody else's backing vocal.
Right.
He needs a girl to ride. You know.
Right. You know, what comes to mind, too, though, is the plaintiff could potentially submit written discovery to. Could they submit it to a non-party? It depends on the jurisdiction, but they might be able to submit written questions to Diddy that he has to answer under oath. And you can only invoke your Fifth Amendment right if you have a reasonable belief that the response could be incriminating. And so if they're just asking him, if they phrase the questions in such a way that could not elicit a criminal response, but instead just trying to obtain knowledge about what happened, about people, you know, who do you know and who might have been there, things like that, he might not be able to validly invoke his Fifth. It gets pretty complicated, but I don't think he can just say, no, screw you guys, I'm invoking the Fifth and I'm never going to have any involvement. I think it's going to be more nuanced than that.
From what you're seeing, does this look like a very complex way in order to try to get at Diddy?
It very well could be, especially with, you know, some of the documentaries that have come out recently and 50 Cent did his and it was pretty unfavorable for Diddy, to say the least. And they've got to find somebody with deep pockets. I don't know if, you know, it seems like Diddy might still have some significant assets just based on what's publicly available. And if they were able to tie him in, that could bring back sort of the financial element of this civil wrongful death suit, make it worthwhile for the attorneys and for the litigants as well. So if they could bring him in, certainly would be a huge win for the plaintiff.
He's not named in the suit right now, but that's where the window is open with the 100 John Does. Like, is the window into this, you know, going after Keefe D, that gets the lawsuit going. You can end up naming more defendants as you go on as the John Does if you so choose at some point in time. I'm wondering if that's the vehicle that's trying to get them there. And then I wonder if maybe there is a financial motive for it at some point, or truth, or just both, or one or the other. I don't know, but it seems to get to kind of step on some lily pads to get to the other side of the pond. If Diddy is there, but at the end of the day, if there was evidence to convict Diddy or to connect him to the death of Tupac, wouldn't we have probably seen it by now? If there's any, and this is 30 years ago, so the digital trail, all that stuff, it's gone. There's not really anything to find. It feels like all that's really left would be if Diddy self-incriminated himself, and all he has to do is shut up or say he doesn't remember. And if that's the only thing that can get him, that might be the only thing that could still get him, right?
Potentially, but one thing that also comes to mind, though, is, you know, let's say that there's an associate. Let's just say hypothetically, I'm not saying Diddy did this, but let's go for a hypothetical, that he did do this. And through the wrongful death lawsuit, they identify some associate of Diddy and they loop that person in and they scare the hell out of that person. And they say, hey, you're going to be liable for millions of dollars. You might go to jail. This could turn into a criminal thing for you. Are you sure there's not more info you want to tell us about Diddy? And then perhaps that person's like, whoa, hey, dude, like, I don't need my life screwed up forever. Diddy did this. And let me tell you how. And let me tell you about these conversations. Let me tell you about these events. Let me tell you about things like that. Now, that would not be, you know, sacrosanct evidence. Certainly could be challengeable. But there are ways to get to Diddy that are sort of peripheral to Diddy.
You know,
Diddy
it's really,
adjacent, if you will.
Yeah, it's really interesting, too, because Diddy's still behind bars, correct? Right?
Yeah.
But I heard rumors. I thought we heard he might be getting out early, good behavior, something like that. But I don't know.
It kind of changes by the week.
Yeah. But what's really interesting about that, Eric, and this is because, like, again, you got to look at the motivations, the intent of what people are doing, of what they think is in their best interest. So these attorneys think it's in their best interest to do this. And so, like you're saying, there's got to be some sort of payoff that they're taking the gamble on. And the fact that, you know, a lot of Diddy's circle remained very loyal to him, even to the very end. But now that the end has happened, is behind bars, I'm curious with you as well. Now that he is actually behind bars for a period of time, I wonder how is, that has influenced his network around him or not. And they might be able to take a separate run at these people from the other side. And the fear factor might be higher in them now than before. It's, you know, from prosecution and such. It's a really interesting, it's really, really interesting to kind of think about that. This, that there's probably such animosity against Diddy from this camp that even if, so they could even say in their mind, you know, we might not get any monetary gain out of this. We might not be able to loop him in, but even the thought of being able to keep him stomped down from this other camp might be enough to motivate them.
It could be. And you know, Robin, if there were, if let's just say hypothetically that he had some involvement, I'm not saying that he did, but hypothetically if he did, and there were some associates who knew about this, their fear of this thing ramping up and getting in trouble civilly or criminally is probably increased. And their fear of Diddy, who's behind bars, is probably decreased.
Yeah, that's what
now, certainly he has reach from the inside, but he's that reach is lessened and his resources have lessened. His reputation has lessened. And so perhaps there are folks with information who might be more inclined now to come out and give that than they would, you know, 5 years ago when he was having his parties and freaking off.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Like, how much has the field cleared up that pulled the fear factor of Diddy down, where it used to just be, well, I'm not going to talk about this because I don't want to have the repercussions from Diddy's goons. Again, I'm not saying he did it, all hypothetical, but 100%. from Diddy's goons coming at me, because obviously we've heard the other stories, Kid Cudi, all of this, you know, firebombing the cars, things of that nature, those allegations. It seems, you know, he had a propensity, allegedly, maybe, in some people's opinions, to bring repercussions to people who crossed him. But if that's no longer a factor and you're caught in the middle and you have knowledge about something, theoretically, you're having to weigh then, oh, I might, you know, owe a lot of money if I don't say something here. I might face some sort of criminal charge or face the wrath of Diddy. Well, you know, the weight is a little bit shifted these days and it's not what it used to be. So I wonder how much that could influence where this might go.
But the only thing I'm going to bring up, you know, Mark Fry in our comments always makes me laugh. And if they are successful, if for some chance, again, all hypothetical, Diddy gets wrapped into this, the only way he'll be able to provide compensation is with baby oil.
There we go. Big shipment of baby oil to the law firm. Congratulations. Right, here's what you get. Yeah.
What am I going to do with that?
What am I gonna do with that?
Set up an Etsy store, you know. That's the right. The leftover Diddy's oil.
Diddy oil. Oh my god.
That's what happens. More money, more problems. That's what you end up doing.
Mo.
All right. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. The links are in the description. Eric Faddis, thank you so much for being here. Robin Drake's latest book, it's out. It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books. Go and buy it right now. You will. You shall. It's great. You'll love it. It's do it now. Okay.
And buy it for someone in your life you think needs to hear that message.
Exactly. Buy it for someone in prison, Jim Bob. Buy it for get two in your prison. You know, one's out. One. You know, two for one. Maybe they could share it. Like, you know, you could like move it or, anyway. Anyway, until next time, for everyone, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something. But this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery. But we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Despiértate, que el $4 breakfast meal deal ha llegado a McDonald's. Incluye un sausage McMuffin o sausage biscuit, hash brown y un café caliente. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.